This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Bangladesh is the world's cheapest country in these days, and there is no alternative market for these retailers to move. So they should be keep doing their business, but in the same time, they should sign this accord and make a safe working place for our workers.
I want to thank you all for being with us. We're going to do part two right after the show and post it at democracynow.org. Kalpana Akhter, Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, Scott Nova, Worker Rights Consortium, and Josh Idelson writes for The Nation and In These Times and Salon.com. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berk, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Emma Littlefield, Martinez DeRosta, Nemo Allen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Naguera, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, Vesta Godarz, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Craig-Meadows, Rakan Penny, and Carlo DeJesus. Our website is democracynow.org. You can see the transcripts, and you can see past shows there. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News. Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance. Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot radio show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
Senator Wyden calls for new public hearings on the NSA spying scandal.
Multnomah County mandates the creation of gender-neutral restrooms in all county facilities.
The Klamath tribes win water rights over the objection of ranchers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 11th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. Multnomah County will now require gender-neutral bathrooms in all its facilities. County Chair Jeff Cogan signed the executive order this morning, which makes Multnomah one of the first counties in the nation to mandate accessible restrooms. Remodeled and new county buildings will require restrooms with single or multiple stalls that anyone can use, regardless of gender identity. In order to minimize costs surrounding the new policy, the county says that current buildings will replace signs on some gender-specific bathrooms. According to the county's website, the change has already been implemented at the Multnomah building on Southeast Hawthorne. Kogan says the move is, quote, an important step in reducing inequalities and disparities, end quote. The county joins Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, who have already mandated restroom access, regardless of gender identity.
A burning cross is not a common sight in the city of Portland, but at 6 o'clock this morning, a 3-foot-high cross was burned at the corner of Broadway and West Burnside in the heart of downtown Portland. The cross was surrounded by traffic cones and street closure signs left over from the Rose Parade this past weekend. Witnesses reported seeing a 6-foot-tall white man between 30 and 50 years old, lighting the cross on fire. According to police, the cross was made out of tree branches that were tied together with trash.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee has called for a second extension for the Washington State Legislature to reach a deal on the state budget. Legislators have been working for almost 6 months to cover a projected $1 billion budget shortfall for the two-year cycle that ends in the middle of 2015. In addition, they've been ordered by the state Supreme Court to allocate $1 billion more to the state's education system. The Republican-controlled Senate and the Democratically-controlled House were recently described as, quote, light years apart by Governor Inslee. The Columbia River Crossing Bridge project needs a commitment of $450 million from Washington State and a permit from the U.S. Coast Guard to apply for federal dollars that will expire if they can't apply by mid-October. The bridge is expected to cost at least $3.6 billion and has been opposed by a coalition of groups from the right and left of the political spectrum. The left-leaning Coalition for a Livable Future, a coalition of environmental, labor, and social service organizations, and the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods have joined with conservative groups, including the Oregon Taxpayer Association, Americans for Prosperity Oregon, and the Cascade Policy Institute in opposing the Columbia River Crossing Bridge. Groups on the left claim that it is a 1950s-style freeway project that will harm the environment without solving congestion problems, and groups on the right object to its cost and what they claim are faulty financial assumptions.
A petition was launched late last week calling out Republican members of the Oregon Senate who are accused of, quote, holding hostage the health provider tax fund in order to gain concessions on reform for the public employee retirement system. For more on this story, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with the publisher of Blue Oregon, who launched the petition.
Can you explain how the health provider tax works?
A few years ago, the healthcare industry, healthcare community, hospitals, and other healthcare providers agreed to basically tax themselves and in order to provide a pool of money that the state would then use for Medicaid, the healthcare program for our most vulnerable, low-income people and particularly elderly, low-income seniors. That money then gets matched on a two-for-one basis by federal funds, which is why the health providers then were willing to essentially do that tax, because by putting a little bit of money into the pot, they get even more money to provide healthcare services directly to low-income families in Oregon. It is a critically important piece of our healthcare funding, and it makes perfect sense. The people who would pay the tax want to pay the tax, and it has been a bipartisan program since its inception. It passed through the Oregon House on an overwhelming bipartisan vote. But what we have right now is Republicans in the state Senate holding it hostage, saying they're going to refuse to support it, not because they don't support it, but because they want a whole lot of other concessions. This is plain old political games at its worst.
How much money are we talking about here, and who's not getting it?
Yeah, I don't know, remember exactly how many millions it is, but it is a critical piece of the funding for our Medicaid programs. Particularly what we're talking about here are low-income seniors in nursing homes. Once you get into a nursing home, you pretty much end up draining your savings, and at some point you become reliant on Medicaid for that funding. And so that's what we are in part talking about here, our most vulnerable citizens. And whether it's hospital care, nursing home care, or health care for kids, these are programs that are critical, and these guys have been playing these political games for about a month now and trying to hold up the budget, the balancing of our state budget in this way, in order to extract concessions related to PERS and other programs.
What is it that Republicans in the Senate say they want in order to release those funds?
What they're demanding is deeper cuts in the public employee retirement system. As you and your listeners know, that's been one of the key questions of this legislative session, is just how much should the state dial back retirement benefits for current workers as well as people who've already retired. And the Democrats have put together a package they've agreed to. They've said they're willing to discuss some additional reforms in exchange for higher tax revenues for programs. But now the Senate Republicans are holding this health provider tax hostage in order to go even further than that, which is unfortunate because a lot of what they're asking for simply doesn't have broad public support. It doesn't have support in the legislature. It may not even be legal in terms of the courts. There's planned games. We can talk about the details, but really what we're talking about here is Senate Republicans playing ridiculous political games rather than the serious business of governing.
Blue Oregon Action has launched a petition to pressure them. When did it start and how's it doing?
We started our petition effort at Blue Oregon Action late last week, and we're rocking along. Got several thousand signatures now from Oregon activists calling on Senate Republicans to stop the games and come together and work in a bipartisan fashion to pass the provider tax. Blue Oregon Action is a fairly new effort, just a couple months old, and you know we're working very hard to encourage our readers to move their activism beyond reading and commenting on our blog to taking action by signing petitions and inviting their friends to join them in this online activism. Just come on over to blueoregon.com and participate, sign up for our email alerts, and sign a petition and begin to take action.
That's blueoregon.com?
Correct.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
The Oregon Senate has postponed the debate and vote on a $6.75 billion school fund until Monday. It is the largest single item in the state budget. Most of the fund would come from the taxpayer-supported general fund and the state lottery, with the last $200 million coming from cuts to the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS, which were enacted in a separate bill. Of the 16 majority Democrats, Chris Edwards of Eugene said the fund is too small to cover his district's needs, while all of the 14 Republicans have also demanded a larger fund, along with even deeper cuts to PERS. A deal could raise the fund to $7 billion, though the extra money would likely be attached to another bill. The Senate hopes to reach a decision by their scheduled adjournment date of June 28th.
A drought in southern Oregon has led the Klamath tribes to call for their water rights to preserve salmon runs. This has set the tribes against cattle ranchers who also use the rivers in question for irrigation of their fields. The native Klamath people have had a long-standing agreement with the federal government that provides for their first right to the water, but they have never until now asserted that right. The Klamath tribe's water rights apply to flows in Upper Klamath Lake tributaries. These include the Sprague, Williamson, and Wood Rivers that run through the tribe's former reservation.
Oyster populations in the Northwest have been falling for years, and a new study from Oregon State University claims to have discovered the reason why. The new study, published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, found that ocean acidification caused by higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere has led to higher mortality rates for oyster larvae in the Pacific Northwest. Researcher George Waldbusser said his team carried out the work at the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery in Neatarts Bay, Oregon. They found that the high acid level in the water is altering how the shells form. That increases the amount of energy the oysters need to form the shell, which that ultimately affects their survival. Waldbusser said the carbonic acid causes the shells to grow much slower, which negatively affects new larvae in their first 48 hours. The study is important because it's the first time a clear connection has been made between the body weight of oysters, how fast their shells form, and the level of acidity in the water. Scientists say the discovery helps them develop interventions that can help larvae counteract water acidity, such as adding an acid to hatchery waters. The study also says another way hatcheries can produce stronger oysters is to breed varieties that show resistance to problems caused by acidification.
The morning after pill will soon be available without restriction to women and girls nationwide. After years of fighting, the Obama administration's Justice Department surprisingly dropped out of the court case late Monday after two judges refused to grant a stay to orders that directed the Food and Drug Administration to make the pill, known as Plan B, one step, available in drugstores without a prescription. Judge Edward R. Corman of the United States District Court for New York's Eastern District ordered the FDA to make the pill available in a ruling in April. The administration appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York City, but that court angrily accused the administration of blocking the drug because of politics, not science, and ordered Ms. Sibilis to reverse her decision. In its letter to the court, the Justice Department laid out how it would order the FDA to distribute the pill. It said the maker of the pill, Teva Pharmaceuticals, has been asked to promptly file an application asking for no age or sales restrictions and that, quote, the FDA will approve it without delay. The Justice Department appears to have conceded the case because it believed it might lose an appeal to the Supreme Court. Women's groups that had been fighting for the pill's distribution quickly hailed the decision, but said they are waiting for the ruling to go into effect. The drug prevents conception if taken within 72 hours after sexual intercourse. The decision is certain to anger abortion rights opponents who oppose cutting parents and doctors of young girls out of the process. For Mr. Obama, the decision rekindles a debate about the pill. He said that as the father of two young girls, the idea of making the drug available to them without a prescription made him uncomfortable. Plan B was approved as an emergency contraceptive in 1999 as a prescription drug only. In 2001, the Center for Reproductive Rights filed a citizen's petition for it to be made available over the counter without a prescription. 2 years ago, the FDA almost lifted restrictions totally, but FDA Administrator Kathleen Sebela stopped the release. The court, among its opinions, ruled that the FDA's agenda was more political than scientific. This action ends the administration's fight and makes Plan B one step available as soon as the manufacturer can begin distribution.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after the newscast, followed by Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy, with the possibility of showers and thunderstorms and a high near 65.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Corporate shareholders are revolting, in the very best sense of that term. More and more investor groups today are rebelling against the top managers of some of the corporations they own. Why? Because the executives have been gambling on political races, not with their own money, but with the money that shareholders have invested in the corporations. In other words, the execs are treating investor funds as their personal pile of political chips, not even bothering to tell the shareholders about it, much less asking permission or consulting them on who to support. While Washington fiddles with proposals to require that corporate executives at least inform investors about all political use of their money, shareholders themselves are taking action. Since 2010, there's been a doubling of shareholder resolutions at corporate board meetings to force executives to disclose such spending and reveal the process for deciding which candidates to back. A New York pension fund, for example, has compelled political disclosure by the managers of 20 corporations in which it has big investments, including Dr. Pepper, Harley-Davidson, and Southwest Airlines. Recently, this pension fund forced a vote on disclosure at the board meeting of CF Industries. CFI's board had earlier opposed the resolution unanimously, haughtily declaring that our corporate political contributions are always both in the business interests of the company and its shareholders. In other words, go away, little people. Stop bothering us. A pod of slugs wouldn't be as clueless as that. Sure enough, by a vote of 65.9%, shareholders emphatically supported the disclosure resolution. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this spreading shareholder revolt against secret corporate politicking, contact the Center for Political Accountability at www.politicalaccountability.net.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, 8 U.S. senators, led by Oregon Democrats Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden, introduced a bill that would require the declassification of opinions made by secret courts operating under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. For example, had the bill already been in law, the National Security Agency, or NSA, would have had to publicly disclose its trove of Verizon phone call data and its PRISM internet data mining program. The bill has notable bipartisan support, including staunch liberals like Minnesota's Al Franken, as well as Tea Party favorite Mike Lee of Utah. The FISA court makes rulings on domestic intelligence operations against U.S. citizens, and its opinions are classified. FISA opinions, like most classified information, are generally only revealed to Congress in closed-door sessions as opposed to public hearings, but many lawmakers say they were unaware of the NSA programs until they were leaked to the public in early June. Senator Merkley believes that an honest debate on communication surveillance cannot be held until the laws regulating it are no longer secret. Credo Mobile, a phone service provider known for its funding of civil liberties groups, endorsed the bill, expressing support for increased transparency in the government's surveillance operations. Despite public outcry and bipartisan support, Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin does not believe the bill will make it far in Congress, and President Obama is unlikely to sign it if it does.
While some lawmakers in Washington have called NSA whistleblower James Snowden a traitor for exposing the agency's widespread spying on millions of Americans, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has taken a different tack. Today, Wyden issued a statement challenging the National Security Agency's decision to allow hundreds of thousands of private contractors to track the emails of private citizens. Senator Wyden made reference to his questioning of the NSA director and the director of national intelligence, James Clapper, back in March. That recording has come back into the spotlight this week after the release of documents by private contractor James Snowden that show the widespread surveillance of emails in the U.S. According to Wyden's statement today, he sent the question to Director Clapper's office a day in advance. He said that he also gave the director a chance to amend his answer after the hearing. Here's a clip of the hearing in March.
Director Clapper, I want to ask you about what I asked you about a year ago, and that was the matter of surveillance and particularly what the rules are that an intelligence agency would have to follow in order to electronically track the movements and locations of an American inside the United States. And I asked you about this a year ago, and you said that your lawyers were studying this, and I hope that since a year has passed, we can get some answers to these questions. So first, let me ask the question, if an intelligence agency wants to electronically track the movements and whereabouts of an American inside the United States, how much evidence do they need?
Well, first of all, let me just say, sir, that particularly in the case of NSA and CIA, there are strictures against tracking American citizens in the United States for foreign intelligence purposes, and that's what those agencies are set up to do. I think, though, when I might ask Director Mueller to speak to this, because what you're referring to is, I think, devolves into the law enforcement criminal area. So, Bob.
Well, let me, and I do want to hear from Director Mueller, but I'm trying to get some general principles out with respect to intelligence, and you've cited certainly some areas that are relevant. But what I'm really trying to do is get an unclassified answer to a question about what the law authorizes.
The law is, of course, as you know, is embedded in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was recently the amendment and to which was recently extended for 5 years. And it places very strict strictures on the intelligence community's tracking of U.S. persons where there is a terrorism nexus. And that is overseen very strictly by both the FISA court as well as within the executive branch, both by my office and the Attorney General. So there are very strict rules about that, as you know, as we've discussed.
But as you know, there are some fundamental questions about the balance between security and liberty that transcend just the FISA question. So what I would like to do is see if we can get a direct answer to the question about when the intel community needs to get a warrant, for example, when a lesser amount of evidence would do, and second, the circumstances when no specific evidence is needed at all. And the FISA law does not specify whether a warrant is required. So that's the reason that I'm asking the question. I asked it a year
ago. I'd like to
ago.
Ask Director Mueller to help me with that question.
And Mr. Director, I'm anxious to hear from Director Mueller, who I greatly respect, but I also need to hear from you with respect to the intelligence community. That's why I asked it a year ago.
And I said, Senator Wyden, in the case of CIA and NSA, who were engaged in foreign intelligence collection, That's a practice they do not engage in.
That was U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden in March questioning the Director of National Intelligence and the NSA Director. Today, Wyden said he wants Director Clapper to appear before another hearing to give, quote, straight answers.
Revelations of NSA surveillance programs have caused a spike in purchases of the George Orwell classic, 1984. It didn't help that the president mentioned the book metaphorically when talking with the LA Times last week. President Obama said, in implementing the programs, that he believed the government had struck the right balance between Big Brother and a program that protects America's national interests. Big Brother, according to Orwell, is a governing body that exerts complete and total control of the thoughts, words, and actions of its citizens. With the exposure of the NSA surveillance, many Americans are concerned that the government has crossed a line. Before the news of the surveillance program broke, 1984 had a sales ranking of 6,750, but it's now listed at 194, and Amazon.com has reported that sales of the Orwellian classic have propelled the novel into fifth place on its movers and shakers list. The 60th anniversary edition of 1984 is currently number 74 in the top 100 sales list. The National Security Administration has been accused of collecting massive volumes of data from Americans' telephones and internet connections. U.S. government monitoring is being compared to conditions described in Orwell's 1984. According to his biographer, Michael Sheldon, throwing out such a broad net of surveillance is exactly the kind of threat that Orwell feared.
The U.S. Congress passed a $500 billion farm bill last night after delaying the passage of the bill since early December. Some groups, like the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, say the bill provides unjustified corporate handouts to big agribusiness companies, locking in subsidies for the next 5 years. According to U.S. PIRG, this bill continues the current practice of disproportionately subsidizing the largest agribusiness, which are already profitable and don't need taxpayer handouts. The group says that although the big agriculture lobby claims to stand up for small farmers, 74% of these subsidies have gone to just 4% of agribusiness, leaving more than 60% of farms not even getting a dime. More than $18 billion of these subsidies have gone to junk food ingredients like high fructose corn syrup.
The United States Coast Guard and British Petroleum declared yesterday that the Deepwater Horizon cleanup is over in three states. The Deepwater Horizon oil rig caused the largest offshore oil spill in U.S. history in March of 2010. A Coast Guard spokesperson says the coasts of Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida have returned to as close to pre-oil spill conditions as possible. Louisiana still has 84 miles of coastline needing cleanup, mostly in barrier islands. But environmental groups are concerned that the announcement has come too soon. Executive Director of Mobile Bay Keeper Chris Calloway says oil washes over Alabama's beaches every day, and the National Wildlife Federation says about 1 million barrels of oil from the spill are still unaccounted for. The Coast Guard says the decision to call off the cleanup is a transition and not an end, and plan to maintain proper staffing to clean up episodic re-oiling instances.
The U.S. Senate voted today to advance a major immigration bill, thus clearing the first hurdle faced by what has become a controversial piece of legislation. The bill is now open to debate in the full Senate. President Obama has pushed the bill forward along with a bipartisan group of senators known as the Group of Eight. The nation's largest military contractors are looking eagerly towards the legislation as a potential source of lucrative contracts for border security. The contractors include Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and General Dynamics, all of whom are hoping to get a piece of the $1 billion in no-bid contracts that will come with the immigration bill. Despite its focus on border security, some Republicans say the immigration bill does not go far enough and are demanding significant changes before they will agree to vote for it. Here's a clip of today's U.S. Senate hearing with Senator Robert Menendez speaking.
As you can see, in 2012, we spent almost $18 billion on immigration and customs enforcement, customs and border patrol, and U.S. visit, compared to about, that's $18 billion, compared to about $14 billion, $4 billion less on all other principal law enforcement agencies like the FBI. And as I said, we're adding over $6.5 billion to the immigration enforcement side of the ledger in this bill. That will put us in the position of spending twice as much on border security as we do on all other law enforcement agencies in this country. But it's not only the money we spend, but how we spend it. The fact is that border enforcement is at an all-time high. We're enacting a strategy to have 100% surveillance and prevent at least 90% of all illegal border crossings across the highest risk areas of our southern border. But there are those who still say it's not enough. We're investing in new technologies to secure the borders, and the number of Border Patrol agents has doubled over the past 8 years, but there are still those who say not enough. But let's be clear. We're making significant additional investments in border security and technology to make sure that at least 90% of all illegal border crossings are prevented. Now, there are some who say, well, we have to have 100%. You know, I don't know anything the federal government does 100%.
Heated debate is anticipated on the border security elements of the bill, which set up a system wherein immigrants may only begin taking steps toward citizenship once certain border security requirements are met.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, June 11, 2013. Israeli settlers injure a Palestinian civilian and soldiers invade West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian man was shot and injured by a live round fired by a guard of the Omrit illegal Israeli settlement built on lands that belongs to residents of Azzoun al-Atma village, south of the northern West Bank city of